Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me here. I've had a wonderful day here at the Kruger Institute. It's obviously a very interesting and stimulating place. I look forward to talking to more of you in the afternoon. So the Eddington Limit in Cosmic Rays. So this is a talk that is going to address some very simple questions about the properties of galaxies and supermassive black holes. And we are trying to address these very simple questions with an equally simple concept, which my collaborators and I refer to as the Eddington Limit in Cosmic Rays. This work is done with has been done with Shane Davis, who's now a postdoc at CETA, Enrico Ramirez-Ruiz, who's on the faculty at Santa Cruz, and most recently a graduate student at Princeton, Lorenzo Cerroni, who's now on his way to Einstein Fellowship at Harvard. So let's start off with an outline. So I'm just going to provide some very basic motivation. And I understand that some of you are not astrophysicists and work in areas that are quite different. So if any of these concepts or terminology seem foreign to you, just please stop me and ask questions. So we're going to start off with some basic motivation. Then we're just going to get to it, the central idea, which is what we call the Eddington Limit in Cosmic Rays. We'll talk about cosmic ray feedback. So if you're an astrophysicist, this is really a talk of what's called feedback, self-regulation of the growth of galaxies and supermassive black holes. And then I'll just give a quick summary. Okay, so let's just start very simply and kind of very broadly. So there are basically two classes of persistent sources at cosmic distances. They are quasars and they are galaxies. Quasars are thought to be powered by the accretion onto or spin down of supermassive black holes. And galaxies are basically just, they're galaxies. They're powered by stars. And they are composed of many different things. They have stars, they have gas, they have molecular glass, they have hot gas, they have cosmic rays, they have dust, they have dark matter, et cetera, et cetera. So they're known properties. They're concretely known properties. Pose some very simple and, I think, intriguing and fundamental questions. For example, what is the origin of the so-called Faber-Jackson relation? The luminosity in stars of a given galaxy versus the velocity dispersion, or you can think of that as the temperature or the kinetic energy of the stars. So that goes like luminosity of the stars goes like the velocity dispersion to the fourth power. So what is the origin of that? What is the origin of the so-called Magorian et al. Relation? So the mass of the black hole versus the mass in stars of these hot, dynamically hot elliptical galaxies and bulges. So there's a correlation, and the correlation is that basically the mass of the black hole is basically, of the supermassive black hole in the center of each galaxy, is basically one part in 10 to the 3, the mass in the stars in that galaxy.
So the Tully-Fisher relation
is I mean, they're similar, but the Tully-Fisher relation is not for elliptical galaxies. That's for spiral galaxies, right. The rotation, the fourth power.
No. I'm just going to address these. I'm going to be more modest and just address these questions.
Okay.
So right.
The Magorian et al. Relation. So it basically says the mass of the supermassive black hole at the center of every galaxy is one part in 1,000 the mass of the stars, or the hot stellar contribution, which means a dynamically puffy or hot distribution of stars in that galaxy. And that's a very tight relationship, and it's a fundamental relationship that I think needs to be solved and addressed. And I think the more interesting questions, actually, are these kind of almost high school or freshman one questions. Why are galaxies faint compared to quasars? And why, well, this is probably a little more of an advanced question, why are radio loud quasars? There are two types of quasars. There are radio quiet quasars and radio loud quasars. Why are radio loud quasars relatively rare in compared to radio quiet quasars? And what we're going to argue is that all these things are related to one another. The answer to all these questions are related, and they all have to do with
with this concept that we refer to as the Eddington limiting constant. Okay, so galaxies, when I say galaxies are faint in comparison to quasars, well, we know they're not as luminous, but why would you call them faint? I mean, we can just take a telescope and we can look at a galaxy and it's this very luminous object. So what do I mean by faint? And we have to understand what determines, you know, the luminosity of objects in the universe. Well, we know what determines the luminosity of quasars in the universe, or we think we know what determines the luminosity of quasars in the universe, and it's called the Eddington limit. Now, the Eddington limit is obviously a very old concept. Eddington, you know, pretty senior. And the beauty of it is that it's very simple, and it works almost everywhere. And if you were to construct, if you were to write down a list of the fundamental laws of astrophysics, if there were such a thing, this would be at the top of, a very short list. So it's worth trying to understand this before we go on. And so what is the Eddington limit? Well, the Eddington limit is basically tells you, it's a statement of hydrostatic balance. It equates the outward radiation force going out versus the inward gravitational force. And in terms of accelerations, the outward radiative force or acceleration is parameterized by F, the radiative flux, energy per unit area per unit time, multiplied by an opacity, cross-section per unit mass, so that's the coupling between the radiation and the matter, divided by the speed of light. And G is just the gravitational acceleration. Now, what this shows here is very simple calculation. What it shows here is that the Eddington limit is independent of geometry, as long as the opacity is a constant over the volume of the system. And so you can see that if you take the opacity in the speed of light outside of this integral, the integral over the area into the flux is just the luminosity. And if you use Poisson's laws of gravity along with Gauss's law of multivariable calculus, you just see that the Eddington limit is proportional to the mass enclosed divided by the opacity. Okay? And for quasars, the relevant Eddington limit is the Eddington limit for photons scattering off of electrons, and those electrons are then coupled to protons through Coulomb interactions. And that's basically called the Thomson opacity. Okay? So if you use that Thomson opacity, you see that the maximum luminosity of a quasar, given by its Eddington limit, is of order 10 to the 47 Ergs per second, and that's basically what you observe for a 10 to the 9 solar mass black hole. Okay? Okay. So clearly, galaxies from this McGournet-All relation, what we know is that about galaxies is that their mass is several hundred to a thousand times more massive than the mass of their corresponding black holes. And since the Eddington limit is only proportional to the enclosed mass and inversely proportional to an opacity, it clearly tells us that the luminosity of galaxies is not capped by the Eddington limit on the Thomson cross-section or the Thomson opacity. Otherwise, galaxies would be 10 to the 50 Ergs per second. It's not a very profound statement, but just bear with me. Okay, so what do we think regulates the luminosity of galaxies? Or caps the luminosity of galaxies? Well, we know if galaxies are forming quite a bit of star, or forming stars at quite a high rate, such as in this case M82, known as the Cigar Galaxy, which is a starburst or a quintessential starburst galaxy, which means that for its amount of mass, it's producing stars at a prodigious rate. So in this case, in M82, which is a bright, relatively local, you know, 5 megaparsecs away, starburst galaxy, you see this wind that's blowing out of the galaxy. And this wind, of course, has mass in it, and its mass, which is ultimately the fuel for star formation. So since this object is blowing out of wind, you can think of it as it's removing its fuel, and there's some level of self-regulation. So why do we get these winds? Okay, so before we get into that, we're going to just talk a little bit about how do winds in objects that we really think we understand, How do they work? And there are basically two types of winds in astrophysics that that we know about. And so they're called radiation or momentum-driven winds. So, and we can think of them as cold winds. And there's energy or thermally-driven winds, and you can think of them as hot winds. Okay? So this object over here is the beautiful Helix Nebula. It's basically a sun, a star just like our sun that's ending its life, going through the red giant and then the asymptotic branch phase. And its luminosity is actually surpassing, at one point in its evolution, it surpasses its own Eddington limit, and it basically just blows itself apart. And so how do they work? Well, the condition for these cold radiation-driven, momentum-driven winds is that the luminosity surpasses the Eddington limit, which means that the radiative force surpasses the gravitational force. And this is just the result of momentum exchange between the photons and the matter, successive kicks that the photons give the matter. The other type of winds are these hot, thermally driven winds, and this is the case of the solar corona. We're living in this wind right now. And so what happens there is, well, you have a star, and the star is being blocked out here, and the star is, you know, to zeroth order, it's just releasing its nuclear binding energy by radiative diffusion through this optically thick radiation field. But inside the star, there are things like turbulence and magnetic fields that pop up through the surface and dissipate themselves at relatively low density and catastrophically heat a very small amount of mass. And so when you have catastrophic heating in the corona, or in a thermally driven wind, the pressure of the gas, or the pressure force of the gas, exceeds gravity. That's because the temperature of the gas exceeds the escape temperature. Okay? And for both cases, you get the wind velocity is of order the escape velocity. And in this case, the wind velocity is of order the sound speed, which is of order the escape velocity. Okay? So if to really get a picture of the difference between a thermally driven wind and a momentum driven wind, ask yourself, well, if you want a change of career and you want to, say, become an astronaut or something like that, how do you want to get into space? Do you want to get into space by momentum driving, or do you want to get into space by energy driving? If you wanted to get into space by energy driving, you would have to heat yourself up to the escape temperature of the Earth. And I guarantee you will leave the Earth, but not in the form that you want. So so that you'd have to be about 10,000 degrees, right? But in a rocket ship, you still remain cold. You know, you remain 300 Kelvin, even though you're going at velocities that correspond to an energy per baryon of order 10,000 Kelvin. And that's because there's just a successive momentum kicks that are being thrown out of the back of the rocket ship. So you can remain cold, yet be fast through a momentum-driven wind. Okay? Okay. So Crystal Martin, who was actually one of my professors at UC Santa Barbara, she actually taught me interstellar medium at UC Santa Barbara, she went out and used a Keck telescope and measured the velocities of atomic material of relatively local starburst galaxies. And the interesting thing about this measurement is that she looked at starburst galaxies that have different sizes, and therefore different sizes, they have different masses, and they have different escape velocities. And what she saw is that there is a correlation between the escape velocity, here it's a circular velocity, which is basically just the escape velocity, and the maximum velocity that you measure by a Doppler shift in these winds, okay? And this looks very similar to the state of the art of a field that we know, understand now a lot better, radiation line-driven winds from massive stars, where in that case you have a massive star that's radiating close to its Eddington limit, and basically the coupling between the black body radiation field with the line opacity, atomic line opacity, in the envelopes of these objects drive out a wind. And in that case, you get another correlation between escape velocity and terminal velocity. And again, this is all atomic material. So you have velocities of order 1,000 kilometers per second. That's about 10 keV per baryon. So that's 10 to the 8 Kelvin. So you have material that has a kinetic temperature of 10, or kinetic energy per baryon of order 10 to the 8 Kelvin, but it's atomic, which means that its temperature is of order 10 to the 4 Kelvin. So this means, or this similarity makes one think that there is a similar Eddington braking momentum injection mechanism that works in these galaxies. Okay? So that's the motivation. And so this is the central idea, which we call the Eddington limit in cosmic rays. So photons are not the only form of radiation that comes from the act of star formation. Okay? So if you take a certain amount of gas and you form it into stars, you do that with what's called an initial mass function. So the famous canonical initial mass function is called the Salpeter initial mass function. And it's this green function here. And what it basically is, the number of stars for a given mass. And it's very steep. So most of the stars are in low mass stars, and most of the stars, most of the mass in stars are in these low mass stars. So what we know about stellar structure is that the luminosity as a function of mass, which is this red curve, increases like mass to the fourth or mass to the 3.5 or something like that, up to the point where you get to the Eddington limit for the photon Thomson opacity, then it just goes like mass. So when you convolve the two, okay, when you just multiply one by the other and you plot it over here to get the luminosity function, you see that the stars around 10 solar mass where there's this break in the curve contribute to most of the light. When you take a parcel or a certain amount of gas and you convert them to stars with a reasonable initial mass function. Now those stars are not only responsible for the light, but they're also responsible for, it turns out, the core collapse supernova. Which is, yes?
Massive stars don't live nearly as long. So the initial mass function, don't you want the mass function itself and not the initial mass function?
Right, right. So basically what will end up happening is over time, this curve will move over here.
Okay.
But for a starburst, when you have just this quick conversion of gas to stars,
That's fine.
That's what's going on. So it's these 10 solar mass stars that are not only responsible for the light, but they're also responsible for the core collapse supernova. And so that's another form of energy release. And we know that
it's basically a fact of astrophysics that core collapse supernova produce cosmic ray protons with an efficiency of 10% or so. So the overall efficiencies of converting mass into starlight, you get about 1 MeV per baryon from stars for starlight, you get about 10 keV per baryon in terms of core collapse supernova energy, and you get about 1 keV per baryon in cosmic ray energy. Okay, and this is what we're going to be focusing on, this little 1 keV per baryon. So though the photons dominate the energy release compared to cosmic rays by a factor of order 1,000, what we're arguing is that the cosmic ray protons dominate the momentum injection. So just a word about the cosmic ray protons. So if you take a spaceship out and you look and you put it above the Earth's atmosphere and you try to understand what the spectrum of cosmic rays in the interstellar medium is, they're basically dominated by 1 to 10 GeV protons. And they have a power law spectrum extending to about 10 to the 6 GeV. And it's these 1 to 10 GeV cosmic ray protons carry all the energy density and are responsible for the luminosity. So you can think of this 1 keV per baryon in all these 1 to 10 GeV cosmic rays. Now, these cosmic rays, we're going to argue, dominate the momentum injection. And how can you understand this? Well, you can measure through various ways the mean free path of cosmic ray protons in the interstellar medium. There are various ways to measure it. And when you do that, the mean free path is of order 1 parsec, 3 light years, 1 parsec. Now, the number density of free electrons in the interstellar medium is about 1 free electron per centimeter cubed. So from that, you can figure out what the mean free path for photons is pretty easily, and it's 1 megaparsec. So 1 parsec versus 1 megaparsec. Now, from the mean free pass, you can then identify an opacity, or at least a ratio of opacities. And what that tells you is that the cosmic ray opacity is of order 10 to the 6 times the Thompson opacity.
Good question. So I'll get to this in a little bit. So what the cosmic rays actually, what deflects them is magnetic field irregularities that are at a pretty small scale in the interstellar medium. Or that's the only candidate that can deflect them, because there's no particle that we know of that has such a huge cross-section that can elastically scatter a cosmic ray. Yeah. So the idea is that the cosmic rays scatter off
the magnetic fields. Ultimately, magnetic fields are just collections of photons. Those collections of photons come from moving charges, which are moving electrons, and those moving electrons are Coulomb-coupled to the protons. And so that's how you anchor or couple the cosmic rays to the mass in the interstellar medium. I mean, that's not that crazy, right? That's not that much of a jump, because ultimately, even the Thompson cross-section, the most basic cross-section in astrophysics, is you're scattering off an electron that has the effective mass of a proton, right? There's no particle that has that property. And what's happening is basically the electron and the proton are tightly Coulomb coupled, so they're exchanging photons. Yeah. Okay, so the ratio, so this is the kind of the leap. The ratio of the opacities is 10 to the 6.
Yeah. And actually the energy density just right in our local neighborhood here in the galaxy in cosmic rays is equal to the energy density in gas pressure, or a little bit larger than energy density gas pressure. So
remember the Eddington limit, any Eddington limit, all you need is a mass and an opacity. Okay? So since the opacity here is so much higher for a given mass, the corresponding Eddington limit in cosmic rays is correspondingly smaller. So you only have to compare to the photon Eddington limit. Because the opacity is so large, you only have to produce 1/1,000,000th the amount of cosmic ray protons. And so that's basically the idea. Now, when you fold in this ratio of kind of radiative efficiencies, so opacity, is cross-section per unit mass, right? And density, you multiply that by density, and this is 1 over the meter mass. Yeah, so the...
Okay. Yeah, they're coupling to the same matter. okay. So if you remember that, or if you take into account this ratio of radiative efficiency
of converting mass into starlight, and compared to converting mass into cosmic rays, and you fold in to the fact that the mass of a galaxy is much larger than the mass of the black hole, and it's determined by the Magornadal relation, and that the luminosity of quasars is just given by its Eddington limit on the Thompson cross-section. If you fold those in, you see that the luminosity from starlight in the galaxy is less than, or of order, the luminosity of its corresponding quasar. Okay, so basically in two lines, you can answer this very simple question. And the only leap is you have to recognize that the cosmic ray interaction with the interstellar medium can be thought of as an opacity. So what are we thinking of, and how does this kind of, what is quantitatively, yes?
A supernova, for example, disrupt giant molecular clouds, disrupt star formations. So do you have an argument that your feedback mechanism is dominant over the other feedback mechanisms?
Yes, but can I talk about this? Let me get that after my talk, because it's like a supplementary slide.
Okay.
I would say three, including ours, there are three feedback mechanisms. I would say they're cosmic rays. There's actually using the photons themselves, which are, you know, the elephant in the room, because they have all the energy release. Actually, if you think about it, what actually has the most energy release is actually neutrinos. that come from the core collapse supernovas themselves. It's a little bit more than actually the star. But let's just assume neutrinos don't do much. So it's the cosmic rays, there's photons. People like Elliot Quatrick, Norm Murray, and Todd Thompson have worked on that. And there's supernova, which the rest of the field is working on. So after my talk, I have a few supplementary slides about that.
But interesting question. Yeah. So what are we thinking of? How can you actually think about this? You can just think of it as the galaxy as being a star. It's a star that has that's being powered by star formation, and it's being held up and limited in its surface density by cosmic rays rather than, say, radiation, rather than, say, photons, like in a massive star. So in the Milky Way, for example, the optical depth for cosmic rays is anywhere from 1,000 to 10,000. That means that cosmic rays, because it's diffusion, they scatter hundreds of millions of order, millions to hundreds of millions of times before they leave the galaxy. And so you can think of it as a cosmic ray pressure, if you want. And a pressure, all you need for radiative diffusion to construct a pressure is you need a flux, and you need an optical depth, and you need a velocity. In this case, it's the speed of light. And like we mentioned before, to answering your question, what's actually responsible for this interaction is the cosmic rays scattering off of small-scale magnetic irregularities in the interstellar medium. So this really allows you to connect, very simply, the energy release, which is the flux in cosmic rays, which then is proportional to the flux in photons, which is the actual most immediate observable, with the gravitational properties of the galaxy itself. Yeah.
With the ordinary Eddington limit is that if you emit it, and above that you blow matter out, which then explains why you wouldn't expect to see things typically emitting at higher than that luminosity.
Yeah.
But here it seems like you would blow out the magnetic fields. But would that turn off star formation? Would that turn off star formation? Would you expect the galaxy to
be? Good question. So we're assuming that the gas that the interstellar medium is
a good conductor. So the magnetic fields are attached to the electrons that are moving in little current loops, and those little current loops can then just attach to the protons.
I shouldn't think of most of the matter as neutral gas. I should think of it as mostly ionized.
It could be mostly neutral, but as long as it's a good conductor, you only need a
few electrons, three electrons per hydrogen to be a good conductor. It turns out. But if it's a bad conductor, this won't work. If the the conductivity is zero, then this won't work.
Threshold in the gas, so the very coldest stuff that's actually star forming now is essentially immune to this.
If it's a bad conductor. So it's a quantity, I've estimated it before. Maybe one could do a better estimate, but when I estimate it, I find that the galaxy, even for star forming galaxies, if you just have a very few number of electrons, it's a good enough conductor.
But the picture one can imagine is that you have this magnetic field that's being blown away, and there are these like dense bullets that just fall through and just go through the magnetic field. As long as those are, I'm not sure if you can say they're bad conductor. Just most of the things are blown away, except for these dense regions that could be falling in. Would you violate your limit that way?
You would have to figure out some type of mechanism that separates the mass from the cosmic rays.
Yeah. Gravity.
Perhaps, but if you go in on large enough scales,
for example, in the Milky Way, if you go just maybe 1 kiloparsec above our heads, above the plane of the disk, these types of arguments can't work because we know that the Milky Way is quite uniform. And say for the corona of the Milky Way, even though there's no star formation going there and it is diffused, the corona of the Milky Way is a lot different in terms of its importance compared to the Milky Way in comparison to, say, the corona of the Sun, in that the corona of the Milky Way has a border 10% of the mass in the Milky Way. So if these arguments I'm talking about, you could come up with some physical mechanism that may, says that is immune to what I'm talking about. Certainly in the corona, where you have 10% or so of the mass, there's nothing you can do. And if you're blowing out 10% of the mass in a vortex, the free fall time, you're gonna disrupt star formation. So. Any other questions?
This one zone model is
justified in that you can relate the pressure or the force to the energy release. And the energy release in cosmic rays is proportional to the energy release in photons, which is again the prime observer. And so you can use this to understand the properties of the bulk properties of galaxies quite simply. Okay, so how does it work to say produce the Faber-Jackson relation? Well, I think this is a secondary important. I think the most important thing is you can just use a simple argument to tell you why galaxies are less luminous than quasars. But if you want to go the extra distance to try to get things like the Faber-Jackson relation, how you do this is through this kind of pictorial feedback loop. So you have luminosity in stars, and then, like I said, you have a conversion efficiency between the starlight and the cosmic ray energy. And then that gives you the cosmic ray luminosity. You constrain the mean free path or the opacity to the of the cosmic rays to the Milky Way value. And that allows you to apply the Eddington limit, which connects you to the mass in the galaxy. You assume the structure of the galaxy, if the structure of the galaxy resembles an isothermal sphere on large enough scales, that allows you to ultimately then relate the luminosity in stars to the velocity dispersion of the galaxy. And when you do that, you basically get the Faber-Jackson relation. Not only do you get the Faber-Jackson relation, you also get the normalization correctly. So should this be taken literally? Probably not, but it's just an encouraging point. So what's the future with cosmic rays and feedback in galaxies? Yes?
Other relation, the Teller-Fisher relation, is a constant, and there's a very interesting question about the origin of that constant. It's an acceleration, and it's there's a funny story about its coincidence with the Hubble scale. Is there a constant, characteristic constant here, and that you explain
for the normalization?
So you explain the normalization. So is there then constant that through your feedback mechanism gets?
That constant, I don't know what that number would be off the top of my head, but where that constant would come into would be, there would be two parameters, which would be the initial mass function, mm-hmm. and it would be what is the value of the opacity, the cosmic rays. So those two would, so basically the slope of the initial mass function and the opacity and cosmic rays would determine the normalization of that relation. Okay, so this is.
You're saying that our galaxy is sort of at its
limit. And it's a limited cosmic ray, sir.
So, is that because it was once bigger and the rest has been blown away? Or can you say, does that imply something about what you would see in the vicinity of our galaxy or other galaxies?
So I'm not really talking about what is the central engine of star formation, right? And so if you think of the galaxy like a car or something like that, right? I'm not talking about the engine. I'm talking about how much fuel you're putting in the gas, right? So or how much you're stepping on the accelerator pedal. So what determines how much for stars you're making is how much molecular gas you have. How much gas you have at cold temperatures and at high densities. But what determines that is how much gas you have available that could cool into that form. And so with these qualitative arguments that I'm talking about, I'm really talking about kind of the bulk of the galaxy. You know, not these small molecular clouds, but the bulk of the galaxy. And I'm regulating how much gas there is in the large reservoir of the galaxy. So you know, several kiloparsecs above our head, I would argue that the Milky Way is above its Eddington limit, much like a massive star in the core, or
maybe a half a stellar radius in the core is below its Eddington limit, but at the surface where the opacity increases, it's above its Eddington limit and the star's slowly blowing itself apart. In the case of a massive star, the mass cut that's blowing itself, that's responsible for being above the Eddington limit, is relatively small. It's like one part of the 10. So the star stays around for quite a few, light cross, dynamical. For, like we were talking to Nyash just a few moments ago, for the galaxy, it's a relatively large mass cut that you're super adding to. And so that's, so you're blowing material out there. And so it can actually really affect what the luminosity. Yeah.
So since star formation is very inefficient on small scales, then if it was more efficient than it really is, then the galaxy would be less massive at the end. So if you can spend being 10% efficient to 100% efficient, then we have smaller yet galaxies to be reckoned with. So would there be then an expected correlation between the efficiency of star formation, which might depend on galaxy properties that depend on mass?
So let's think about that. So if a given molecular cloud made more stars per unit time, then
it actually does, then you make more cosmic rays. If you make more cosmic rays, yeah. So you would have to take that into account, right? So I guess what I'm integrating over is if you know what the surface density of the galaxy is, you convert that into the star formation. But I'm just basically ignoring that.
So next steps. Can we actually quantify this?
Is there a way of quantifying this and making this kind of a quantitative topic? And so the answer, I think, is yes. And just let me briefly, just one slide, tell you about this. So now we're in a new modern era of gamma ray astronomy with the Fermi Space Telescope, which is detecting photons of order GeV and higher. Basically 100 MeV to several tens to 100 GeV, and the Cherenkov detectors, the ground-based Cherenkov detectors, which are detecting photons that are of order TeV in energy. And so what are they, and so it turns out that these instruments are detecting star-forming galaxies, local, so far five local star-forming galaxies in the gamma ray emission. And so what they're actually detecting are cosmic ray protons, and this is the first time we can actually see this. We've never been able to see this before in external galaxies, is cosmic ray protons that are being produced by presumably quark cloud supernova in these other galaxies that are diffusing around, and then every once in a while, one will randomly just smack into an ambient hydrogen particle, hydrogen atom. And when it does that, it makes a spray of mesons. And of those mesons, one of them is a Pinot meson. And those Pinot mesons decay into high-energy photons. And that's what you're basically seeing. So that allows you to constrain, if you know what the surface density is of these systems, which we think we know what they are, it allows you to constrain the mean free path of the cosmic ray protons directly in other galaxies. And if you use this with help from synchrotron emission from cosmic ray electrons, there's this whole other species, cosmic ray electrons, that also get produced by quark collapse supernova. Now, the cosmic ray electrons above 1 GeV, if they're scattering off the magnetic field irregularities, they're going to have the same diffusion properties as protons. So the cosmic ray electron and the synchrotron emission from them can strain a different volume of the galaxy, or the mean free path of a different volume of the galaxy, than the cosmic ray protons that you observe through their secondary. So you now can really quantitatively do cosmic ray astrophysics in other galaxies, and most importantly, you can constrain the mean free path in other galaxies that have wildly different properties than the Milky Way. And when you can constrain the mean free path from this right here, that means you can constrain the opacity. And if you can constrain the opacity, you can tell quantitatively whether or not this galaxy is above its Eddington limit. These galaxies are above the Eddington limit of rays. Yeah, so you there are ways of figuring out what, or at least getting a handle of what the density.
So that's the next step. So
let's move on to
I know which galaxy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this sucker right here is the Magellanic Cloud. This is a molecular cloud complex in the Magellanic clouds. This guy right here, this is Fermi, this is M82, and you know, this is another guy, you know, this is the cigar galaxy I was talking about before, and this is NGC 253, which is just another star-forming galaxy, it's just a little bit further away. And so, yeah, you can definitely, I mean, they're basically just point sources, but that's, you know, that's still pretty
cool. You're seeing this cosmic ray process is happening in the galaxy?
In
not
the
in our atmosphere, like, was that?
No. So basically, what's happening is, so this is some galaxy, we'll call this, you know, galaxy X, right? And there's a core collapse supernova that goes off in a galaxy, okay? And what happens is this core collapse supernova radiates cosmic ray protons and cosmic ray electrons. And so let's just think about what happens to the cosmic ray protons. So it radiates a cosmic ray proton, and the cosmic ray proton just diffuses around and tries to leave the galaxy. But in the meantime, very rarely, this cosmic ray proton will smack into just an ambient hydrogen. And when it smacks into that, then you make a spray of mesons, and of that spray, some of those are pinots, and those pinots decay into photons. And those photons have the exact same spectrum as the source of protons. So you can get quite a bit out of this, and it's pretty exciting that you can actually measure the cosmic ray mean free path in other galaxies. So, yeah.
So let's move on to black holes. So this topic is a little bit more abstract, but I think it's also equally interesting. So what is the origin of the so-called McGournetall relation? The mass of the black hole is basically proportional to the mass in the stars with a proportionality factor of order 10 to the minus 3. And why are radio loud quasars relatively rare compared to radio quiet quasars? Okay, so this is the McGournetall relation here. So again, we have stellar mass versus black hole mass. And it works over 3 or 4 decades in mass. And so when you see this, you say, oh, it's a power law. So it's self-similar. Power laws are self-similar. And it works over this huge mass, this huge range. So there must be some universal mechanism at work. That's what everybody thinks when you see that. That's the feeling that it invokes. That's why this is such an amazing plot. So, and that's the party line. But so let's just consider this very simple argument. So let's define an efficiency for self-regulation, or an efficiency for feedback. We'll call it epsilon. And let's say that's equal to the binding energy in the gas, fraction of gas times mass in stars times velocity dispersion squared, divided by the energy released in the black hole. Okay? And so what this tells us is that the efficiency is proportional to the mass in the stars multiplied by the velocity dispersion squared, okay, which depends on velocity dispersion. Mass in stars usually is said to go like velocity dispersion to the fourth if you use that Faber-Jackson relation, divided by the mass of the black hole. But the mass of the black hole, since you're on this relation, the mass of the black hole divided by the mass in stars is a constant. It's 10 to the minus 3. You're on this relation. So what that tells you is that the efficiency has to scale with velocity dispersion to the square, to the second power. So what that tells you is that whatever is responsible for this relation cannot be independent of scale. Okay? So that's the first thing that we want to point out. So what we know about the growth of black holes is that they grow by accretion. And so they grow by accretion in such a way that the accretion is radiatively efficient. So you can, by measuring how much light you see in the universe from accreting black holes, you can determine how much mass went into the black hole if you know what the radiative efficiency is. And the radiative efficiency is just basically determined by general relativity. It's determined by the position of the innermost stable circular orbit around that black hole of a given spin. So if you say the black hole has, you know, a moderate amount of spin, say its spin parameter is 1/2, its radiative efficiency is about 10%, which corresponds to the innermost stable circular orbit of order 10 gravitational radii. And so this is basically called the Sultan argument. Okay? And so what we know about the growth of black holes is that it's, you know, if you're a 10 to the 7 or 10 to the 8 or 10 to the 9 solar mass black hole, you grow by what's called, you know, Eddington limited accretion, that you're accreting at your Eddington rate for about 1% of the Hubble time, and it's independent of your mass of the black hole. So whatever is responsible for the growth of black holes, at least in this optically luminous, radio quiet phase, doesn't seem to care about the fact that the feedback depends upon the mass of your black hole, or in other words, the velocity dispersion. Okay?
The sigma squared. So the key point was just that those are both dimensionless numbers that are changing. Is that the
dimensionless?
When you said that shows that it's not that it's
so if you look at the McGoran, you know, the standard reaction when you look at the McGoran relation is there is some universal thing that's happened, right? And what this says is whatever's happening is not universal.
Because those numbers are dimensionless but not constant?
Well, it scales with mass. So basically, what this means is for a black hole in a small galaxy, okay? You're in a galaxy that has a velocity dispersion of order 30 kilometers per second, okay? And say you're a black hole that's in a galaxy that has a velocity dispersion of order 300 kilometers per second. For every unit of black hole mass accreted, the ones in the big guys have to do a lot more work than the ones in the little guys, because the depth of the gravitational potential well in the big guys is 100 times larger than in the little guys. That's all I'm saying. So per unit of black hole energy, the black holes in the big guys got to do a lot more than the black holes in the little guys. That's what I'm saying. But at the same time, the growth of the black holes in the big galaxies and the small galaxies seems to be go ahead in the same way. It's just this radiatively efficient, optically luminous accretion that lasts for 1% of the Hubble time, that is going at basically of order unity the Eddington rate. So that's what we're trying to address. So perhaps since the efficiency for feedback is dependent upon the size of the system or the velocity dispersion in the system, perhaps we should look for AGN phenomena that also depends upon the size of the system or the mass of the system. And there is, so the optically luminous radio quiet phase doesn't seem to depend upon the size or mass of the system, but there is phenomena that does, from AGN, that does depend upon the size of the system, and that's the radio loud phenomena for quasars. So right over here, you have what's called the Fanaroff-Riley 2 source, which is, so there's a black hole here, and there's a jet that's being blasted out. And this scale right here is of order 1 megaparsec. And the amount of energy in this particular jet is of order a significant amount of the rest mass energy in that black hole. And the thing about radio loud phenomena is that you only really see it, or you only see it powerful in the biggest sources. And that's the trend that we want. Okay, so the general idea is that we want to connect the radio loud activity to the mass buildup of the black hole. And so you have to know just a little bit about black hole or AGN and quasar phenomenology, which just the phenomenology in itself is a very complicated subject. But for the radio loud phenomenology, what we think, everything, all the difference that we see in the radio is just a viewing effect. So you have a jet that is relativistic, that's spitting out energy and material along some direction. And that when you're looking at the jet edge on, like this guy, you only see these radio lobes at relatively large distance from the central source. And it's basically isotropically emitting radio emission by synchrotron emission, which is basically just hot electrons being cooled by magnetic field or cooling off of magnetic field. But when you look along the beam of these jets, these are called blazars. And there are two types of blazars. They are the BLAC, okay, which is called BL acetate. This is the first one. They named it after the first one.
and then there's flat spectrum radio quasars. So the BLX, basically nobody, or it's believed that they are not actively accreting, or at least the total amount of energy coming out of them is relatively small, which means that the total accretion power involved with them is relatively small, which means the total mass buildup is relatively small. The other category are called the flat spectrum radio quasars. And the flat spectrum radio quasar, you can just think of it as a disk. There is a disk. You can actually see the disk in the optical. And that's just a normal disk that's accreting material in a radiatively efficient way, presumably. And there's also accompanied by a jet. So this allows you to connect the buildup of the black hole with this jet activity.
In the optical?
Yeah. In a flat spectrum radio quasar, yes.
You don't image the disk. You see the ultraviolet radiation from
the... Yeah, you see the spectra. You see it.
But it's a little confusing. I thought in that state, the party line is now that they don't have jets. They're actually radiating, you know, most of the binding energy is being released in photons, and so they don't form jets in that state.
No, I don't think so. So for the canonical example of 3C279, which is the canonical flat spectrum radio quasar, you see the double humps emission, which is indicative of, this is explained. So the idea that we have is, how do you get cosmic ray protons from these jets? That we're arguing that you actually make cosmic ray protons in these jets, and you make them actually within the galaxy. And so the idea is that you have a black hole, and there's a disk, and we're saying it's creating a jet. And what you're looking at the jet along the axis, in this direction, what you're seeing here as the means of producing emission, i.e. this, as the artist's depiction, are these what are called relativistic internal shocks. So you eject a shell of matter that's relativistic, and then you wait some dynamical time of the central engine later, and you eject another shell. And the shells don't exactly have the same Lorentz factor, so they smack into one another.
And so these are called internal shocks. And this is, if you guys know a little bit about gamma ray bursts, this is basically where they lifted that idea for internal shocks. They lifted it from the Blaze community. So you have these internal shocks, and what you see in these internal shocks, you see quite a bit of radiation. So these are the spectral energy distributions of some of these quasars. And the one up here is a flat spectrum radio quasar. And so this peak comes from synchrotron emission that's from electrons that are cooling off of magnetic fields. And then you take that same synchrotron emission, and then those same electrons take their own synchrotron emission and inverse Compton scatter them up to the gamma rays. And so that's what you're seeing. You're seeing emission that's being relativistically and geometrically beamed at. And that's why these fluxes, if you look at here, 10 to the 48, in some cases you see 10 to the 49 arcs per second, well above the Eddington limit. And you see rapid variability that can only be explained by this relativistic Doppler system. So that's our model. And so you have these internal shocks, right here, and these happen about one parsec or so away from the central engine. You can calculate that if you just know what the Lorentz factor is of these jets, and you can figure out what the Lorentz factor is by looking at the variability. And so when you make these shocks, they're collisionless shocks, and kind of the lesson that we know from modern gamma ray astrophysics is that whenever you have a collisionless shock in the universe, you make cosmic ray protons. And so what we did is we estimated how many cosmic ray protons you make. And from that, we can connect the accretion power, or the jet power, to the cosmic ray luminosity. So actually, since I'm running a little late, I'll just go through this very quickly. So the picture that we have here is that you have the central engine, and you have this region of internal shocks. And instead of a supernova remnant, these regions of internal shocks are basically sources for cosmic ray protons, and those cosmic ray protons stream, diffuse and stream out of the galaxy, scatter with the galaxy, the interstellar medium of the galaxy, millions to hundreds of millions of times. But if you're to just ignore, six or seven pages of the Astrophysical Journal where we derived you know, how much actual energy you get out, which is, you know, kind of a detailed exercise in high energy astrophysics. Just say, ignore what we're doing and just consider this. In the Milky Way, the luminosity in cosmic ray protons, you can measure it. It's kind of it's about 10 to the 41 Earth per second. Maybe it's a little bit less than that. Now, again, remember for radiation pressure, the radiation pressure is basically equal to the flux times the optical depth divided by speed of light. So for a radiolab quasar, for the biggest guys, the luminosity in the jet, which has a Lorentz factor of 10, so they're basically cosmic ray protons, 10 GeV, is 10 to the 47 Earth per second. So you literally have six orders of magnitude larger potential cosmic ray luminosity in galaxies that have these radio-loud AGN in them. And so what we're pointing out is the most energetic collisionless shocks in the universe actually happen in these radio-loud AGN. And by several orders of magnitude.
Sounds like a contradiction in terms.
Yeah, it's interesting. So how do you get a shock without collisions? Yeah. So
we're actually living in one right now. So we're in the bow shock of the Earth, and so we have a solar wind. For example, you have a solar wind coming from the sun, which is this energy-driven one I was talking about before, and you know the particles are totally collisions. But then all of a sudden, what happens is it runs into the magnetic field of the Earth. And what happens is, as long as you have some magnetic field, that magnetic field will basically, in a very short amount of time or a very short amount of distance, change the Hamiltonian of each one of these particles very rapidly. And so, since all these particles have random phases, their orbits just go all in different directions. Now, you don't make a thermal distribution immediately, but you don't need to make a thermal distribution. All you have to do is convert bulk flow energy into random energy, and you call that pressure or temperature. And so as long as you have a little bit of magnetic field, such that the Larmor radius is smaller than the size of the system, which is almost always the case, then you're fine.
Yeah, and you can observe the magnetic field. You can observe their magnetic field because they're making synchrotron emission. So you know that there's some magnetic field. Yeah, and that's what happens in supernova remnants as well. So whenever you have these collisionless shocks, you generically make cosmic rays by a mechanism called Fermi acceleration, diffusive shock acceleration, which is a form of Fermi acceleration. Okay, so I am running a little bit late. So
let me just tell you that this is not just just theory. This is based on this is motivated by several decades of observations. For example, the statement that the radio loud guys are only the big quasars. So this is from several decades of data. So this is a paper by Ari Lahore. So R is the ratio of radio loudness to optical luminosity. And as you can see here, it only happens in the big sources. If you actually look, which we now can do, look for galaxies that have radio loud activity at high redshift, where you're actually at redshift 2 or 3, where you're actually building up the black holes, the mass in black holes in the universe, which happens at a redshift about 2 or 3. So in this case, we're using the VLT. Nicole Nesvadba is using the VLT and using what's called an integral field spectrometer, which on every point on this or every pixel on this plot, you make a spectrum. And since on every point you have a spectrum, you can get a characteristic velocity of the gas. And so what you see here is the velocity scale goes from 500 to 1,500 kilometers per second. And this is all atomic features. This is rest frame optical, I think oxygen 3 or something, which corresponds to an ionization temperature of kind of the 4th Kelvin. So it's atomic gas, but it's moving around in this galaxy that has a radio loud quasar in it at 1,000 kilometers per second, which corresponds to a kinetic temperature of 10 million degrees or 100 million degrees. And so here's a case where you have cold, fast winds that are quite energetic and powerful. And we'd argue that these winds are being generated by the cosmic ray luminosity at the center of these galaxies powered by the AGN. Let me just skip over that. So I think if you're trying to study AGN feedback, and if you accept this argument that it's probably not just the normal optically luminous quasar activity, that we should look for activity that is not self-similar, that actually varies with black hole mass, or that is not scale-free, that actually varies with black hole mass, then if we look for the amount of radiolat activity, what we'd argue is what you should go measure is not the luminosity function of quasars, but the kinetic energy function, how much energy you're putting out in a jet as a function of black hole mass. And what we'd argue is that this should follow the binding energy of the host galaxy itself and should be highly peaked at the high mass end, which is qualitatively what you see. But the question is, does that quantitatively work out? That has to be checked in detail with observations. So just as a basic summary, I think I've been able to argue to you that just by considering the simple concept that we call the Eddington limit in cosmic rays, by making the jump that you can think of cosmic rays scattering off of the interstellar medium through an opacity, you can understand a lot of the bulk properties and simple properties, but unexplained properties to a large degree of galaxies with this very simple concept. And I think now in this new era of gamma ray astronomy, we're in the position to quantify some of these ideas. So thank you.
Thanks, Harry. Questions? Mayesh.
So could you show in a couple lines in the board where this sequence of the force comes from? Because I couldn't see it in your formula.
Basically what you do is, you basically say you do hydrostatic balance.
Mm-hmm.
So you do hydrostatic balance, and you say that L, the L over tau. Okay, yeah, right. So basically, what you do is you do hydrostatic balance F equals G, right? And so this is the gradient of the gravitational potential, right? And you can also multiply this by F by rho, right? Now you integrate this over the volume of the galaxy. Okay, so this will end up giving you, dQV. So this will end up giving you an optical depth and the luminosity. And so this allows you to relate the luminosity and optical depth to the gravitational content. So the right-hand side, if you assume that rho and g follow an isothermal sphere, that ends up giving you the Faber-Jackson equation.
Okay.
That's how you do it.
Yeah. So I thought, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, when I've seen maps of cosmic rays in the galaxy, they look like they're in the plane, right? But if the mean free path is very, very short, shouldn't it look isotropic around us?
Good question. So what you're seeing is, what you're referring to is secondary emission. These proton, cosmic ray protons, mm-hmm. smacking into ambient proton in the interstellar medium, making a spray of mesons. One of those, you get pinots, and you make gamma rays. So that's the maps that you're talking about. So the idea there is that the galaxy is basically uniformly filled with cosmic rays, but the gas in the midplane of the galaxy is all clumpy and structured. And so you have this basically substrate of cosmic rays, and you have these little sources of matter, and it's only where you have these sources of matter where you get gamma ray emission. And so that's what you're actually seeing.
I was thinking of maps of cosmic rays.
The only thing you can actually see is the gamma rays secondaries, because the cosmic rays themselves, the protons themselves, they're like dark energy, and you can't see them. They don't radiate.
The old ray type things, right? They make maps.
But that's very high energy. And
again, that's the same. I mean, you're not... Oh, very high energy. Like directly measuring
Auger cosmic rays, like ultra high end. That's actually the cosmic rays coming themselves. Those are from, you know, 10 to the 20 electron volt cosmic rays. Those are presumably coming from somewhere outside our galaxy.
For them, the Larmor radius is large.
Bigger than the size of the galaxy.
Yeah, but for low energy ones, I don't think you can make a map.
Well, I mean, but they don't
you could make,
way, they
you
don't
make a map,
map,
but
you
could
find their way to the atmosphere.
You can make a map, it's just all isotropic.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is isotropic. That's,
yeah.
So
yeah,
the answer
isotropic.
Is yes, it is isotropic.
Yeah.
Isotropic.
Yeah. You could make a map.
Mm. So I was trying to parse your last three bullets, and so what you've done, I gather, is you've taken, so you're saying, why are galaxies so faint? And this is your way of expressing this problem that has surfaced over the last 10 years, which is that when you calculate the luminosity function you would expect from dark matter halos, what you find, you expect to see a power law based on dark matter halos, and light follows mass, and what you notice is that it turns over. So it's the galaxies are too faint and not blue enough today. Problem. Is that the same problem?
Sort of. It's really saying at the high mass end, like really just this, at this basic level, what we're saying is at the high mass end, if you take the biggest galaxies and the biggest black holes, if you look at what the luminosity of the biggest black hole is, and you look at the luminosity of the biggest galaxy, why is the luminosity of the biggest galaxy smaller than the black hole? Even though it's 1,000 times more massive. So that's basically what these arguments can explain. In order to do what you're talking about, we really need to understand what the cosmic ray mean for you, how it varies from galaxy to galaxy. And that's slide that I showed you, which is how you go about figuring out how the cosmic ray mean for you path varies from place to place.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the next step.
This may be a very good question, but if this pressure from the cosmic rays is important. Doesn't it change things like study of, velocity distribution and, I can't think of the right word, but the galaxy, the velocity versus radius curves?
Well, it's really affecting the gas. So once you make stars, the only thing the stars stay in the initial gravity.
You mean rotation.
Rotation curves
are made using neutral hydrogen.
Well, I mean, if the neutral hydrogen fields the cosmic rays, and they're not just being moved around by gravity, then this will affect, yeah, the structure of the rotation.
So it means that it would go the wrong way, though, explain away dark matter.
Oh, no, it doesn't. Yeah, it has the wrong effect. But we changed the analysis, that's... That's the question, would it change the law?
Well, if there's some other force other than gravity, you would have to conclude it.
So is it a significant effect?
I haven't thought about it.
Other questions?
Okay. Thank you very much.